And here we are with a new episode of the Drivery Podcast, and our today's guest is Will Fischer.
Hello.
Nice to have you here. So let's talk about all the things you are doing all day.
Sure.
And tell me a bit more about you and what are you doing?
Absolutely. Well, I'm the managing partner for Voxdale's Berlin office. Voxdale is an engineering service and product design firm, and we're headquartered in the Antwerp area in Belgium, and we have an office here in Berlin as well. Our offices here are at Motion Lab, which is the not drivery hardware co-working space, but I also maintain an office at the drivery so that I can get to know the community a little bit better.
So what brought you to the drivery?
It's just such a great combination of companies and community. I enjoy that everything about it, the staff, the fact that I can sit out and encounter people that I know and enjoy and can have interesting conversations. So mm-hmm. They're a good place for interesting conversations.
Try to tell us a bit more about Voxdale. What are you especially doing?
Sure. So we're an engineering services provider primarily. We also do product design, as I said. And we have kind of several major industry verticals, one of which is mobility. Mm-hmm. We also work in medical devices and some on kind of industrial and automation sorts of things. But for mobility, there's very few places to be in Europe, and the drivery is one of those places. Mm-hmm. And so that's why we have a presence here.
And so you're producing hardware or software or services or everything?
Oh, yes. I should have said that. We're a hardware engineering okay. services company. So we do mechanical engineering, electrical engineering, IoT integration, and software in as much as it relates to hardware. So mm-hmm. there is no real part of our business that is software exclusive. Basically everything we do, you know, of course, a device that's generating data, a scooter or a bicycle or whatever, mm-hmm. Maybe uploading data to the cloud, and in that case, we have the software engineers necessary to handle that data and hand it off to our clients.
Mm-hmm. So you studied and worked in the U.S. and are living there mainly?
I live in Berlin currently.
Right now, yeah.
Schöneberg. Yeah,
okay.
A lovely place. but yes, I am originally American. I was born and raised in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've spent most of my career in California, except for a two-year period where I was in graduate school in Chicago. And so I was there working in medical devices. That's mm-hmm. kind of, that's my personal background, at an implant for diabetes treatment. And then I went to get my MBA. So I started uh-huh. as an engineer. Now I have both degrees in engineering and also business. And then I came here.
And so you're a multiple founder,
that is
say.
True.
You did yes. Found some other companies in the past?
Yes, absolutely. So mm-hmm. While I was in business school, I founded D20 Robotics, which was based on what had been a hobby project of mine before going back to graduate school. Me and several friends had been building cocktail robots to make
kind of the typical American garage business. So
painfully typical.
Okay.
It was literally a garage in Oakland, mm-hmm. you know, and I pulled the motorcycle out and pulled the welding equipment in, and we started building cocktail robots. I actually, one of my German friends visited, and he said, this is so crazy. This is the most American thing I've ever seen. I mean, you know, in some ways it did hit that stereotype really hard. I mean, you know, at midnight one night we built several robots, one of which uses facial detection to fire a shot of liquor into your mouth from 3 meters away.
Mm-hmm.
And at midnight one night we're testing this by shooting out into the street, you know, because we don't know what the range of this thing is going to be. Because this was before we figured out it was 3 meters or tested any of this stuff. So, you know, we're all standing out there. We're testing it with water because it's midnight, and we're out there, you know, giggling as it misses us or, you know, hits us in the shoulder or something. You're not supposed to go in your mouth, but it just misses wildly.
So I think meanwhile you are doing some other testing methods, not this one anymore.
That is true. That product is no longer. It was great fun to build mm-hmm. that product for sure. Certainly I've gotten my experience out of it, and it was interesting to try and commercialize that, and along with many people who were pursuing a business degree with me, we refined the business really, I thought, quite well. The important lesson I learned from that was that you can sell all you want to the people who want your product, but if someone is able to say no, you absolutely can't have it, mm-hmm. it doesn't matter how much you sell it. For us, this was the case. We initially wanted to use the product to market alcoholic beverages. We figured we can create these really hilarious videos of people getting, you know, taking shots of alcohol mm-hmm. that just kind of fly into their mouth. We can brand it. We can put a brand and logo on that stuff. We can help that you know, when someone shares this thing on social media, it automatically tags the company. All of these things. Very clever on that. The marketing departments were very enthusiastic. They saw this. They were like, this is incredible. It's going to have great engagement. Yeah. We love this thing. The legal departments did not think that. Every lawyer who looked at our product said, not a chance, you know, for many reasons. Some of that is, you know, liability. What happens if somebody gets hit in the eye with a bunch of vodka? It's not ideal, but it does happen. I've taken some of those shots. They're not pleasant, but uh-huh. they're survivable. And the bigger thing is that if it's construed as fun, uh-huh. it counts as marketing yes. to children. And so for very apparent reasons, very reasonable reasons, they said, like, look, you can't market liquor to kids.
Well, after your dad got back his garage, what was your next idea then?
That's what I came here to Berlin to pursue. So mm-hmm. I came here because I had a friend already here. She was well-established, also American, but married to a German. We co-founded a company in the smart furniture space. So quite a departure from cocktail robots and medical devices. We had this theory that if you could build a bed that could, using automation, move itself out of the way, you could save a lot of space in a small apartment. We started working on that in April 2019. By January or February 2020, we were in a good place. We had a prototype that kind of almost worked, mm-hmm. which is a good start. You know, hardware is difficult. It's hard sometimes to get that prototype to where it needs to be. And we timed it perfectly. I mean, the pandemic happened, and we had a thing that was a sit-stand desk plus bed combination. Mm-hmm. It was just like all in the same space. So if you were like me in the pandemic and you had a 30-square-meter apartment, yeah. which felt like a tiny little prison cell, then it was a phenomenal product for that. But we had applied for grant funding with the Investment Bank of Berlin, and they had delays because of Corona, because people were working from home, all of that sort of stuff. So it delayed us getting that grant money. Kind of at the same time that we ran out of money, we were going to be fundraising, but of course it was hard to get in front of investors because, again, Corona kind of ground all of that to a halt. And truthfully, my co-founder, who is a wonderful person, I think entrepreneurship might not be her happiest place. And so we ran into co-founder issues as a result of that. So lessons have been learned. Certainly I was part of those co-founder issues. I'm not trying to put that all on her. But so those are the companies that I've founded, and I'm proud in both cases. The products we built were fantastic, and it's not necessarily all about building products, I've learned. You need to have the whole entire thing all together at once. And it was from there that I started freelancing for Voxdale. Voxdale was at Motion Lab. There was my kind of the other managing partner, Marijn, was at Motion Lab. They needed one extra engineer. I was like, I'm an engineer. Yeah, I've got all these other qualifications, but I need to pay the bills. So I started working for Voxdale, and they said, hey, let's grow this team from two people. And that's where we are right now. So we are growing quickly. We started hiring a little over a year ago, and now we have 8 employees in the Berlin office and are kind of thinking about who's going to be next.
And you found some good ones here? It's complicated in every area right now to find good stuff.
Yes. I think, in my mind, hiring good technical staff is a delightful challenge, which I really love. It's something that I did at my first job. It's something that I've done here, and it's a joy for me. And I think Voxdale has something unique, which is we can promise a young engineer who's straight out of school, you can be on 10 projects in your first year. You will learn the basics much more quickly. You'll accelerate your career. You'll get interesting skills. You know, you may not know what you're going to learn, but, you know, we have one engineer who's currently doing regulatory research, which is maybe not the sexiest thing of all time, but he's also done laser cutting stuff and how to bend metal and blender design for an actual kitchen appliance. So all sorts of interesting things. CAD, of course, we use as a day-to-day in our business. Yeah. So, you know, getting better at those skills. So it's a really nice way to level up your skills quickly. And I think for more senior employees, you can go and say, hey, you might be a subject matter expert in this. We offer you the same thing, you know. Not only can you keep your expertise, but you can branch out and apply that knowledge or knowledge that you kind of miss having to other things. So we end up pulling in people who desire to be more generalist. And I think in general that makes us a much better service provider because those generalists work well together and also produce a really good product because they know more breadth, and they can dig into that breadth to provide a good service.
Yeah. There is a big thing today. I think I don't know anyone who's not talking about AI.
Yeah.
So how does this impact your product design or your design of your services and products in general?
You know, at the moment that's an interesting thing. It has not made its way to physical hardware design yet. It will. That is inevitable. One thing that we've seen is one of our engineers decided that what he wanted to try was to put SolidWorks will output. SolidWorks is a computer-aided design program. It makes 3D models for products when you're designing your product. And he took the output from that, which can be text. He put that through ChatGPT just to see what would happen, and had it try and said, you know, like, hey, add this feature, do this thing. And the results were comical in the way that you would see, you know, when you watch AI do things. At the moment, it's quite good at text, which makes sense with natural language processing. As it tries to use that natural language processing instinct to look at what is really kind of peculiar looking code, but not code that has enough training data like software, it has these hallucinations, which is the term that you use, like same thing it has with art, you know, like sometimes it produces a beautiful portrait, but sometimes it's a portrait with 16 eyes, you know, and that's kind of what we see right now with respect to the way that AI approaches CAD. I think though, the future would be that we would start to see similar things with CAD as to what we see with like CodePilot, which is this this plugin that takes someone writing code. They can, you know, it'll recommend a function, and that function might take a normal programmer 10 minutes to write and write correctly, but CodePilot can crank that out in 30 seconds. So you see a huge time saving there that is awesome. But at the same rate, it's not doing an entire program, and it's definitely still quite far away from that, because that requires kind of thinking and extrapolating, getting outside of the problem rather than seeing kind of what the single next step is, but knowing what many next steps are. And to do that, you have to have a goal.
Yeah.
And at the moment, software, hardware, poetry, business emails, all of these things, you still have to have a human being setting the goal.
But you think in the future, AI will have a bigger impact also in product design, also in hardware product design?
I would hope so. And there's some things that are I think, I would imagine, are kind of low-hanging fruit, and certainly there are people going after this with software. For example, changing a design around so that it is easily made with an injection molding machine. That's something that years of experience get you, you know how to do that sort of thing. But for a junior engineer to kind of have the background knowledge is really hard, and to have that like augmented by AI would be amazing. I am certain someone is working on this. I don't know of any products right now that do that, but the moment that they come out, they're gonna make money. So that's a good place to be. But in terms of long-term disruption, I think what we'll see is kind of a tendency to move kind of in two ways. The kind of engineering brains will probably move more and more analytical. So it'll be more about, okay, what's the analysis that's necessary to make sure this product succeeds?
Yeah.
In the case of a mechanical engineer, that could be stress analysis or fluid motion, thermal analysis, that sort of thing. And then you'll also have the product designers who are going more in the human direction. And that might actually be, I mean, I love numbers. For me, that might be the more interesting direction, which is, you know, a computer can extrapolate a lot, but it doesn't necessarily understand how a user is going to interact with your product. And so you really need good product designers to empathize with the human being, see where the value is that is created by the interaction with the product, and get into that mindset. And that's something that is very far away for AI.
Yeah. Another not less important thing is always to get enough money for all these projects.
Yes.
What did you do for the fundraising for your companies?
So at the moment, we work entirely for clients. Clients come to us and ask for us to build a portion or an entire product for them. That could be something as simple as, this product is currently leaking. Can you fix that?
Yeah.
That is a very simple project for us. It's a relatively limited one. It could be all the way up to, hey, we've got a medical device that's coming out of a research institute like Fraunhofer. We need the entire product design. So think about the users, where they're going to be, who they're going to be, what they're going to need, then create the physical design, then build some prototypes and get it in front of users, see how they interact, then rinse and repeat. And that could be quite complicated. That could include thermal simulations. It could include stress analyses. It could include firmware development and UI and UX on a physical product. So there's a lot of interesting things that can happen in there. So we aren't actually doing the fundraising, and those companies then would pay us to do that work. They get their money from a variety of sources. Sometimes it's venture investment. Mm-hmm. We work with a lot of startups. Sometimes we're working with Mittelstand and small and medium enterprises, in which case, you know, they have a revenue stream and they say, oh, we need something more innovative, or, hey, our product needs to look sexier, or, hey, we are worried about this competitor coming in. What can we do to protect our market share? Mm-hmm. That kind of combines a little bit of corporate strategy and business strategy with the product design that we do. You don't produce or engineer products in a vacuum. You have to be looking at what the company will gain out of it at the bottom line. Yeah. It's very important. So how they pay for it, it can also be grants. For example, when you have research coming out of an institute like Robert Koch or Helmholtz or Fraunhofer, they're trying to commercialize a product, and that could be grant funded. So you end up on a consortium. You've got a group that's working in Germany. You've got a group that's working in Spain, a group in Lithuania, a group in Italy, you know, like, and that you bring all these people together to get EU-level grants. There's also a lot of local grants. We work with grant writers. Mm-hmm. So if a startup comes to us and says, hey, we really love what you guys do, we want you to build our product, we don't have any money, we say, all right, let's talk to whoever it is, the right grant writer for that company.
And especially here in the driver, you have lots of different companies, lots of different startups here. Could you already start some corporations here in the house?
Yeah, absolutely. We've pitched a couple of companies so far. We don't have any currently in progress. Mm-hmm. But part of the reason that I hang out at the drivery is just to make sure that people know that we're available, that we are accessible, that it's easy to come talk to me, or if my business partner, Marijn, is here, talk to him. He's also wonderful and extremely knowledgeable in engineering. And we're happy to give whatever advice we can. So even if it's not, you know, a paid consultancy, you just need kind of a quick question. I need a supplier for this, or we're really struggling with this thing, or whatever. Mm-hmm. Come talk to us.
Yeah. How do you envision the future of Internet of Things in mobility, especially?
This is really fun. I mean, I think we're seeing mobility is in an interesting place right now because of the funding that's going on right now, there's a lot of funding getting pulled from mobility at this exact moment, which is a little scary, I think, if you're a mobility company. So you have to be looking for what the user really is going to value, because that's at the end of the day, it's the user that's going to pay for you. Even if you're a B2B company, even if you're looking at, you know, what is this big company going to pay us to do? That company is selling something that is eventually going to be purchased by a consumer. And so you have to look at what the value is there. And I think for IoT, a lot of that stuff is in reducing the hassle of IoT. Where is my device going to be? You know, whether it's a scooter or a car, you know, so GPS is a big part of that. There's some of that is doable in software, but as hardware gets better, as GPS tracking gets better, that is going to change some stuff.
I think there are lots of points. If you think about the Paris will ban the electric scooters, because they are laying around everywhere. You know, I think that can be done much better.
I think so too. Actually, you know, it's interesting. I was in Paris a few weeks ago, and they have these designated parking spots. I was really impressed. That seemed extremely functional to me.
Yes.
You know, but it's interesting to see. I believe Helsinki has just picked up a similar program this week. But other cities are seeing the Paris model, which for whatever reason the voters in Paris don't like, but makes great sense. And as a user in Paris, I went to Paris and I spent 90-95% of my trips, like individual single direction trips while I was within the city, were taken on modern electric mobility solutions, you know, e-bikes, e-scooters, these sorts of things.
I think that's very useful in a big city. Yeah. It's the same here in Berlin, but the things are laying around everywhere. That's the bad point.
Yes. And I think being able to geographically constrain those things, and in Paris, I mean, it was brilliant. You know, you're never more than 50 meters away from a parking spot. Mm-hmm. They'd taken parking spots away from automobiles, which can be very unpopular in Germany. But the result was that you were never so far away. And I think that combined with a program kind of like the Yelby program, which the drivery is all in on, and I think is absolutely brilliant as well. I think if you start to combine these sorts of revolutions together, you end up with a picture of modern urban mobility, which is really futuristic and very exciting. it's cool because I can rock up to a city that I don't know at all, like Paris, and I can get around. I can help the ecosystem there by changing batteries out. It'll drive me to a place where there's a battery exchange location and a laundromat. So there's so many cool cutting edge innovations that are happening on that to get around a city that I'm completely unfamiliar with Paris. Mm-hmm. I don't really know how to get around there, but I can still have my smartphone on a rental scooter and get from point A to point B to see all the sights. It's absolutely great.
So I think in the future you will never run out of ideas. Do you have any to work on, or?
I will not run out of any ideas. At the moment, I do. There are none in progress. And I think, you know, it's always tricky at the very idea phase, you know, when you still got it kicking around in the noggin, to be open about those sorts of things. You know, once you've got something built, you see, oh my gosh, this thing's so hard. Then that's the time when you should be sharing it, because then you know that everyone else who might be interested in trying that idea will look at it and go, oh yeah, that's a pain in the ass. I don't want to try that.
So what do you think, what kind of innovation will emerge in the coming years? Or what are we missing right now? What do we really need?
That's a tough question. You know, that's a really, really hard question to ask. You know, if I knew the answer to that, I'd be off with a profitable startup somewhere. And so I guess I can only offer really frustrating, vague things. Manipulation is still a really interesting challenge. You can put a doona in a person and send them off to a road somewhere in the countryside, and they can shovel dirt and run the thing, you know, the thing that's going to, the steamroller that's going to make that into asphalt. And at the end of the day, you have some road. Making a robot that is that multifunctional is extremely difficult. And so what you end up with is many disparate different types of robots, each of which is doing a specialized version of each thing. So I think there's a lot of room to develop a more multifunctional robotic manipulator, all of that sort of stuff. I've joked with some of my friends who write software that long after our brains are no longer necessary, we'll still be using our hands. Because frankly, like, nothing in the mechanical world can really measure up to the human body yet. Mm-hmm. We're just not there. And so I think that's something where there's a lot of room for improvement. I think human-computer interaction or human-technology interaction is also a really exciting place. As things on digital media are more and more easy to fake with a combination of deep fakes and AI and all of that sort of stuff, you know, you can make a convincing-looking picture of the Pope. You can make a convincing-sounding Obama speech that sounds like he's the one giving it. As that gets more and more convincing, trust is going to migrate off of the internet. It's going to come back to just like you and I are right now, which is that there's a real human being sitting across from me. Computers and technology will need to interact in that world. And so I think there's a lot of available space there for human technology interaction that'll be very exciting. And I'm not saying that we should try to fake human beings and human presence. I don't think we'll ever be able to do that. But I do think there's still a lot of exciting territory within that realm.
It seems we are in a very interesting world like this. Yeah. And I hope you will never run out of ideas. I'm sure you won't. And I hope to hear much more of you and your ideas in the future.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for chatting with you here.
Yeah, this has been wonderful. What a great opportunity. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.